Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Welcome to The Book Pod with Corey Perkin, the fortnightly podcast that brings readers and writers together. Today we acknowledge the traditional owners of the Boon Wurrung Nation where this podcast is produced and pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
Welcome to The Book Pod. It's Corey Perkin with you for another episode. And I had a wonderful chat the other day with Shan Pryor. Shan lives in Melbourne. She's a writer, a broadcaster, a musician, and a creative writing teacher. And you probably know her name from her radio days on ABC here in Melbourne. And also she wrote a regular column for The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. I first met Shan in 2014 when she had released a book called Shy, a memoir. And I was co-interview with John Fain on the ABC Morning program in Melbourne, and we had Shan as our guest, and I was absolutely riveted by her conversation and the fact that somebody so articulate and confident and sunny and just such a wonderful big personality in the studio actually had written a book about how shy she was, and she traced back her history of being shy. Such a fascinating book. I highly recommend. Well, Shan has a new book out now, and it's called Childless, A Story of Freedom and Longing. And it's Shan's story of always wanting to have children but never being able to. And then she finds herself at 50, childless, and coming to terms with what all of that meant. This is such a beautiful book, and I hope you enjoy the conversation. Shan Pryor, it is an absolute delight. And also, I'm filled with gratitude to have you here today, because your new book, Childless, A Story of Freedom and Longing, is a very courageous book on your part, but I'm filled with gratitude on behalf of all of those men and women who have been unable to have children and who wanted them. You've taken us through a real minefield here, Shan.
Sure have.
It's a bit of a tearjerker, this book. Close to my heart, and we'll go into that a bit later. This is your story, your journey. But I was filled with so much sorrow and grief for so much of this book, but also fundamentally the power of love and self-love to get us through something like this. So I'm utterly intrigued. Why did you put yourself through the process of writing this book?
Yeah, no, it's a good question, because it was quite the process. Look, I think I mostly did it for selfish reasons, although it might not read like that. I have forever used writing as a way of processing difficult things and talking to myself about those difficult things and trying to understand my own behaviour. So in large part, this memoir was a form of writing as therapy for me. I, as you will have read about, I did not manage or even acknowledge the deep grief that I felt over the years about my childlessness. And I got myself into a lot of hot water by not managing or acknowledging that grief. So I thought I've got to find a way of thinking this through, I think best on the page. And then I thought, well, if I had all of these difficulties with those experiences of infertility and with the grief that came with that. I'm not going to be all alone in that. You know, there will be, I assume, many, many other people, men and women, who will have dealt with this sadness and perhaps for lots of complicated reasons not been able to talk about it or have it acknowledged publicly or process it. So, yeah, but mostly I did it for me.
Well, we used to have a bookshop and people would come into the shop saying, oh, where is your self-help area, please? And we would say, no, we don't have a self-help, but we do have some books that relate to self-care and self-love. And people would look at us like we're a little wacky because we didn't follow any kind of strict library format. But I do feel with this book that it is very much about self-care and self-love. And I think if you were reading this, not just about childlessness, but a lot of aspects of when things don't kind of go the way that you planned, how do you then, to use that hackneyed word now, pivot, but how do you pivot into a gentler space or a happier place? I'd like to take you back to your 20s, because this book really does start with you in your 30s acknowledging in a partnership with a chap called Jack. You both decide that you might like to get pregnant and you go on that journey. But let's take you back to your 20-something self. Where were you at that point thinking about pregnancy, relationships, the future? Was it all yours? Were you slightly concerned that maybe this kind of dream was not, or this traditional view was not the thing that you wanted to do? Where were you at?
Oh, look, in retrospect, I think I was so naive and it was a form of hubris, really, because to be honest, it never occurred to me that I wouldn't get this thing that I wanted. I had wanted to have kids my whole life. I don't remember there being a time when I didn't think, oh, great, I'll get to have kids eventually. And, you know, that was an interesting position for me, because in my 20s I was working as an environment campaigner and I was, you know, immersed in some very, very dark prognostications about the future, which, of course, we're seeing coming true all around us now.
So this is the 90s, just to give people...
No, this is the late 80s. The late 80s. I was working for the Australian Conservation Foundation, campaigning on ozone depletion, global warming, anti-nukes, so the really, really big, scary global issues. And quite a few people around me, my friends and colleagues in the environment movement, were really debating with themselves about whether they could or should bring a child into this world, because, you know, it was already looking really scary. I did not have a moment's indecision. I probably had a few moments guilt when I kind of learnt more and more about population and sustainability and overconsumption, but I just told myself it's okay, because I'll have kids who like me, will try and save the world. So... yeah, I just always thought that would happen. Even if I thought I wasn't going to be in a relationship at the right time, I knew that I would find a way to do this, or I believed that I would find a way to do this. So, you know, I was busy having all sorts of really interesting different careers in my 20s and early 30s. And then, as you pointed out, in my early 30s, I was in a relationship with a very, very lovely man who also wanted to have kids. And so we were like, okay, well, we'll just do this now. And as you know, that's not how it turned out.
Yes, let's get pregnant and have the baby before the next holiday. Mm. I hear that a lot.
Yeah, or while I'm in the perfect position to get maternity leave.
Sian, I'd love you to, there's a particular part of this book at the very beginning, really. I'd love if you would do us the honour of reading it. It's when you have some sort of an epiphany or an epiphanous moment about you and your work with the planet and where to from here. And I wondered if you'd read that little... I must say that the layout of this book is terrific. For readers who haven't yet come across Sian's book, it's shorter, sharper, and I really mean some of them are quite sharp and twist the knife in your guts kind of chapters. And they're like little essays and you go back and forth in time. And at the end of it, we have a complete picture of your journey over 30 years. And this is sort of the beginning. So if you can read, that would be lovely.
So this is a chapter called Convergence. For reasons that, you know, have no basis in anything intelligent, I decided to make every chapter heading end with the sound "ints." So this is convergence. It's 1989 and I'm cycling slowly across a bridge spanning an 8-lane freeway on my way to save the planet. I've spent the last 3 years campaigning on ozone depletion and global warming for the Australian Conservation Foundation, trying to wrap my unmathematical brain around the delicate sciences of climatology and oceanography, trying to make those delicate sciences into powerful stories that will nudge people to action. In the process, I've learnt things I wish I didn't know about the workings of the circumpolar vortex and the potential loss of island nations. The world has become a different place, full of institutional roadblocks and oblivious over-consuming humans. At least one of my campaigning mates has given up on the idea of having children. When he turned 30, he had a vasectomy. Adding to the population will only make things worse, he told me. Why create people you love and condemn them to an uncertain future on an overheating planet? It was hard to argue against his logic. But I still want a child. Not right now, I'm too young and too busy, but later, definitely. One would be great, a second would be a bonus. No more than that, because I don't want to make the overpopulation problem worse. And my child will try to save the planet, just like me. Cycling against the wind, I turn my head and see long lines of vehicles stretching eastward to the outer suburbs of Melbourne. The cars are not moving. They're idling, waiting for the peak hour crush to dissipate, spewing out carbon dioxide. I brake to a standstill on the side of the bridge and stare at the ribbons of cars snaking out to the horizon. And it overtakes me at last, the dread I've been pushing down for the last 3 years. It rises from the pit of my gut to my throat, and I hear myself. I'm whimpering. Standing astride a stationary bicycle above the freeway, fingers white-knuckled on the handlebars, I'm crying. Because now I know. I can't do it. The end of the world is nigh, and it's my fault because I haven't done enough and can never do enough. I'm too small and too tired and too afraid of the future. I swivel the bike around, scrape away the tears, and ride home again as fast as my legs can manage. 3 decades later, a Swedish schoolgirl is addressing a United Nations climate summit in New York, and she's snarling. She's lecturing the grown-ups about tipping points, feedback loops, climate justice, betrayal, and forgiveness. She wants to cry. I can feel it in my own throat. But she won't. She's a genie released and she's trying to magic up some shame before it's too late. I do the maths. She is exactly the age my first child would have been. And I'm one of the grown-ups she's lecturing.
Wow. So when you and Jack decided, or when you were really firm on the idea that you wanted a baby, you were no longer in that environmental space, were you?
Well,
I mean, personally, committed to, but not working.
Yeah, not professionally. No, I had moved into other jobs. I stayed on the council of the ACF for quite a few years, but even that I eventually left because I just felt like, well, A, my knowledge had sort of atrophied about that, you know, those areas of science and politics, but also I was finding it really emotionally hard to know so much about the bad stuff happening to the planet. So, yeah, I was working as a radio presenter for the ABC and I was also studying opera part-time. So I was very busy.
Well, we loved your arts show on Sunday mornings here in Melbourne. I don't know whether it went national. Did it go national?
No, it was just Melbourne. Yeah.
And your background as a performing artist, as a singer, as a musician, was so important to that program, to bring somebody in who actually knew what it was like to stand in front of a crowd and put on a gig was I found really fabulous. I could never understand why they let you go.
I don't think I understand either still.
20 years later. I got a feeling that was a moment of grief too.
That was devastating. It was a devastating moment when I learnt that my contract wouldn't be renewed. And, you know, it was a devastation that compounded the background devastation, which was Jack and I had started trying to have kids and I'd already had 2 miscarriages. You know, behind the scenes. And of course I didn't talk about that on the radio. That would have been completely inappropriate. But as you would have read, I literally had a miscarriage mid-broadcast while I was on air, Yeah.
I didn't tell anybody. Sian, I am amazed at that. I'm not, because women do incredible things to, and performers and journalists do, to keep the show on the road. We've all seen that in newsrooms. People, I mean, I could go on and on about the courage of people to keep doing their job, but that was pretty remarkable, that chapter, I have to say.
Oh, look, it was very difficult to write. It was one of the most difficult chapters to write, and not just because it was a very painful memory, literally and emotionally, but in retrospect, I'm baffled by that moment in my life. I'm baffled about why I felt like I just had to keep going. I mean, granted, it was an outside broadcast. There was a live audience there. We were out at Heidi Museum of Modern Art. So if I had disappeared mid-program, which is what I would have had to do if I had, you know, decided to do something about this miscarriage, you know, there was no one there to take over. It just would have, I don't know what they would have done. But it does feel like a kind of madness. And you know, it's a madness that I would like women not to have to do in the way that I did. You know, I would like the world to be more informed about the fact that this stuff happens to women all the time. Women are having miscarriages all over the joint, and mostly people don't know, because mostly we don't talk about it. But, you know, it's both intensely physically debilitating and emotionally horrible to go through that experience. So, yeah, what was I thinking?
Well, the reason why I loved the passage that you chose to read, and the different passages, the focus here, of course, is the title of the book is Childless. The focus is your particular journey through 3 decades of this want. But I think there's a lot of grief here that you are also dealing with, and as you acknowledge, it does go back to losing your father as a tiny baby. And I'm kind of not surprised with that anecdote of the live broadcast at Heidi that you continued, because your mother continued. So I wondered if you could tell everybody what happened to your dad that day and what your mother was then faced with as a young widow and how she just kept everything together to get you through. But also that particular moment that you realise that children need to be smiled and babies need smiling and laughing faces around them.
Yeah. So, look, some people may already know this because I did write a bit about it in my first memoir. Yeah, Shy. When I was 3 months old, my brother was not even 2, my sister was 5, my mother was 27. My family went to the beach for a picnic with a big group of people, and 2 of the people got into trouble in the surf, and my big brave father, who was an excellent swimmer by all accounts, went out and rescued them, and he got the 2 of them back close enough to shore for them to be saved, and then he drowned. And my mum was like standing on the beach with these 3 little kids watching this happen. This is way back in 1964. And I can't even imagine how that must have felt for her to have this absolute cataclysm take place in front of her eyes. And they had no money, you know. She had kids. She couldn't do much work. He was an orchestra musician. They didn't get paid much at the time. So, yeah, my mum suddenly found herself having to keep the remnants of this little family afloat. And she did. Somehow she did. She was a woman of immense fortitude and intelligence and stoicism. And, you know, I think partly that's a generational thing. Her generation and the generations before that were mostly brought up to be very stoic. So somehow she kind of kept us together and eventually remarried 5 years later. But it's only in recent years that I've started thinking about what impact that must have had on me as an infant. I suppose for most of my life I've thought, oh, lucky me, I missed out on all of that terrible tragedy. You know, I was oblivious. But the more we find out about infant development, the more we understand about how just about everything that happens to an infant can have an impact. And I'm sort of assuming that my mother would have gone from being a smiling, relatively happy person to someone, you know, in the depths of grief and fear for herself, for her children. So, yeah, I imagine a lot of the smiling would have stopped. And, you know, I've started reading about the impact of trauma on infants when their parents go through trauma. And it's quite a thing. And I have lived with lifelong anxiety and a lifelong intense need to please my mother. And I can't help thinking that in part, at least, both of those things may have come from what our family endured that day and in subsequent years.
Well, I want to talk about your mum a bit later on as a support when you're going through IVF, but I certainly know from first-hand experience that when you lose a parent suddenly and it's traumatic, that life kind of stops and your family has to rebuild in different ways. And we know from, for example, people of yours and my generation who have had parents or grandparents who were Holocaust survivors or the children of Holocaust survivors, that there is this anxiety that envelops the family. And whether the tragedy is relived and talked about or whether it's not, it's always there. It's like another person. I remember a friend of mine whose parents were younger when they came out from Poland after the war, but they were Holocaust survivors. And I remember her saying that you felt that there was this other presence in your family and you just wished that they would just go away so you could have one happy meal or one happy family holiday or something like that. And I think it defines who we are. I used to say that I was not defined by my father's death, that it wasn't a life-defining moment, but it was. And the minute we acknowledge that and then explore it, as you have in your other earlier book, Shy, as you said, but this one also in particular, I felt it's also made you very brave too.
Well, I suppose my main role model was my mother, and she was insanely brave, I think. I don't mean literally insanely, but,
Is she still alive?
Sadly, no. Sadly, she was a victim of COVID getting into aged care homes.
Oh, Sean, no.
Yes.
Did she know you were working on this book?
Look, she sort of did, but she sort of didn't, because she had Alzheimer's in the last 4 or 5 years of her life. So she certainly, didn't know the extent of what I was going to describe in this book. But anyway, she was amazing, and she set the bar very, very high for everyone in our family, particularly her children. We've all got PhDs because that seemed to be the thing you did. We've all endured various different types of travails, and on the surface, me and my siblings all seem like highly functional, you know, relatively successful human beings, but I know what's underneath all of that, you know, and the levels of anxiety that fizz around in our family.
You're listening to The Book Pod, an audio community that brings writers and readers together.
You said earlier a desire to please your parent. Do you think in part there's some explanation wanting to replace a family that was part of the drive of wanting to create family with Jack and then later with Tom? And I have to stress, they are not their real names, but these two important relationships in your life. Do you think you were trying to recreate a family?
It's a really good question. I don't know that I was conscious of that at the time but in retrospect, maybe that's part of what I was doing. I mean, I have to say, you know, when my stepfather turned up when I was 4 or 5 years old, things improved vastly for our family, because he was and is a very, very lovely, kind, caring person who, you know, just enabled a whole lot of things to happen in our family which probably couldn't have happened otherwise, including my mother having a change of career and becoming a, you know, a highly respected psychologist. I guess because on the surface my family life had been so happy, really. It sounds strange given that I've just told you about this terrible tragedy, but, you know, I really had a very privileged childhood in many, many ways. So, yeah, I guess I thought, oh, well, it's a pretty good way to live your life. But it was more that I very, very much loved children. I loved spending time with children. Children tended to respond well to me. I felt like I communicated well with children. You know, I had lots of younger cousins when I was growing up who I adored. And so I just was like, well, that's fun. I want to do that. I want a bit of that for myself.
Do we call that the maternal instinct?
I don't in the book. And it's, as you would notice, it's something that I kind of shy away from discussing because I think it's very, very fraught, that idea of instinct. And, you know, and if you talk about a maternal instinct, then how do you explain the many, many women who don't want to have kids? You almost imply there's something wrong with them, which I do prefer, not believe.
I prefer the idea that we just have a vibe with kids, because some people honestly do not like children.
Yeah.
And, or babies.
And why and should they?
Exactly, exactly right. So, Sian, if we go back to the book and if we follow this chronological order of you and Jack, or particularly you, because you had that feeling in your 20s, oh, this will happen when I want it to, I'll be able to get pregnant, and then you have miscarriage and miscarriage, and at some point you feel that you can't go on with Jack in that relationship. Was it because of the pressure, do you think, of trying to get pregnant that it was having an impact on that relationship?
Definitely that was a huge factor. And not just the pressure of the trying, which, you know, as most women will know, is a kind of agony of hope, you know. You're waiting for this thing to happen, and hopes are dashed, and you try again and your hopes are dashed.
Well, a month period cycle is a long time to keep waiting.
Yeah, it's awful. But I think also, and this is what I realised really only in retrospect, I think that my grief and probably his grief also were very eroding of our love, of my love, I guess. And we didn't manage it very well. I don't think we even acknowledged it. He was and is an incredibly optimistic person, which is one of the many reasons I loved him. But when you're dealing with intense sadness and repeated failure, optimism can come to feel like something you're shut out of because you can't feel it yourself. You start to feel a bit hopeless. So that, I think, really drove a wedge between us. And I started to feel, well, and it also coincided with the loss of my radio career. And so I think I went into quite a deep depression.
Loss of confidence.
Loss of confidence, loss of an idea of the future. You know, I'd always, until then, thought my future was going to be fab. And, you know, I'd been spectacularly lucky in so many ways. It kept looking like I was going to keep being very lucky and have a fab life. And then things started to turn around and I just didn't really manage that very well. And I got very depressed and I had a really serious back injury and ended up in hospital for that. So, you know, things went to shit for me for a while. And that relationship didn't survive all of that, all of those disasters, sadly. Yeah.
So you meet Tom, who is a musician, tours a lot, has had previous relationships and has had children, and he makes it very clear to you that he doesn't want to have any more children, but you love and adore him and you decide to stay. Was there something in the back of your mind that you were thinking, can a leopard change its spots? Might I be able to change him? Am I the woman who can? Or even perhaps I can have a baby on my own anyway?
Yes, to both of those things. I think part of me hoped that I might be able to persuade him to change his mind. And then I had this fallback position, which was, well, if I can't, then I am aware that it was possible for me to try IVF as a solo person using donor sperm. And, you know, I was lucky in that became available, you know, at the right time for me in history for that to be an option. But, you know, again, it got really messy when I tried to persuade that man to change his mind. And it got messy because even though I told myself, oh, well, he has a right to not want any more children, he already has three, you know, he's getting on, part of me just actually thought, no, if he loves me enough, he'll do this for me. So I had two completely different narratives going on in my brain, one of which seemed like the kind of fair narrative and one of which seemed an uncontrollable need in me to try and get him to change his mind because I wanted this thing.
Did you realise at the time you had these two stories, these two lines playing in your head?
Well, yes and no. No, in that I I didn't realise enough to be able to realise what a mess that was making of my head. But I remember having those thoughts. Yeah, I remember thinking to myself, you know, what? How can he deny me this thing that I want? And surely he can see that it would make us both terribly happy. Which is a sort of a self-obsessed point of view in a way. And as I write about in the memoir, that didn't work out. He didn't want to. I couldn't change his mind. And so that's when I attempted solo IVF using donor sperm.
So this is where I want to bring you back to your mum, because you do this and you have one embryo left. And I think of all the times when I teared up in this book, I think that was the time when I was most emotional, as I am now when I'm talking about it. And it doesn't work, and you ring your mum.
Well, my mum became my support person through that year, that terrible trial of IVF. She would pick me up from the appointments and we would go and have lunch or coffee, and I would cry and she would hold my hand. So, you know, this last time when it didn't work, and I was running out of money, you know, it's expensive, as everybody knows, and I was doing it alone, I was running out of money, and I was running out of emotional...
But you were still with Tom.
I was still with
Tom. But the journey, the IVF journey was very much yours.
Yeah. And so I had this moment sitting in a cafe with my mum, and I just suddenly realised I could not do this anymore. It was too hard. I needed to...
You say to her, I'm so tired, I want to get away, but when I try to work out what I want to get away from, I realise it's me. That is huge.
Yeah, but I'm not the only person on the planet to have felt that, I'm sure.
I'm sure you're not, but can you tell us that? And then you say to her, I need to stop now. So I wondered, with my question to you is, when you said I need to stop now, did you mean I need to stop this treatment, or I need to stop trying to get away from myself? Because that is a very dangerous place to be in.
Yeah. I meant I need to stop this treatment and this quest, this hopeless quest of mine, in order to stop feeling like I needed to get away from myself. I needed to recover, rediscover who I was when I wasn't this person obsessed with trying to have a child, who I was professionally, who I was with my friends, who I could be in Tom's family. Because, you know, there were consolations. He had a big, amazing, loving family. And
you pay tribute to that. They accepted you. His children accepted you completely. And even one of his sons, when the son has a child, you form a wonderful relationship with that little step grandchild, I guess we call the child. There's a lot at stake.
There's a lot at stake. And, you know, surprise, surprise, the relationship doesn't last.
Well, I have to say, at this darkest, deepest, most awful time in your life, I have memories of, you know, meeting you when I used to work at the ABC radio with Doug Aiton, and a call in, and there you were. I followed your music career. Obviously, I read your columns in The Age. We overlapped there briefly together as columnists there. And I was very aware of this sunny, beautiful, exquisitely voiced person who, when I read the book, I can't align the two. I'm very glad you came out of the dark place, because by nature I think you are a sunny person, even though interestingly there were not those smiles when you were a baby, which you talk about. What impact does not smiling parents have on babies? So you came out of it.
I'm still coming out of it. It's 10 years since that relationship ended. And as I write about in the book, the end of that relationship didn't just mean the end of an intimate relationship. It meant the end of my relationship with that whole family. So I had some very, very dark years. And I bet people seeing me professionally during that time would have still thought, oh, there's sunny old Sian again. But, you know, and that's a formed persona, I suspect, or it was at that time.
It must have been exhausting.
It was.
Did you
utterly exhausting?
Did you sometimes go home and collapse? Because I think we've all done that when we've had things we've covered up.
It saved my bacon, because
you kept busy.
I kept busy. I've always had really interesting work. I have always had a lot of energy, and all the kind of nervous energy generated by that sadness got shoveled into my work. And I was also, you know, channeling my mother. I was determined not to let this sadness derail me or derail the public perception of me. And, you know, that's also something that I have been forced to think a lot about in writing this book was, yeah, what's been the cost to me of so assiduously cultivating a public persona of control and strength and, yes, sunniness and stoicism, and it has been exhausting. I've been tired most of my life.
Well, it's interesting, this book. What impact does this have on, if we call it Brand Shan? And I thought about this reading a book by a friend of mine a couple of years ago now, Caro Llewellyn, who's now the director of the Wheeler Centre. But Caro had it all on paper, just like you. And she was a director of literary festivals around the world.
I wrote stories about her and her marvellous career in New York. She was incredible.
She's had an amazing time, an amazing life, and she's highly talented, and she's diagnosed with MS. And she talks about it in her memoir. So these are confronting. I sometimes wonder, well, my first thought is always, good on you, writers, for having this courage. But then I think, oh, what is the residual damage of this? Or, in fact, is it all upside when you write this? And I was thinking about this when I'm reading your book, Childless, and you talked about you now are a teacher and a lecturer in creative writing. And you have this creative writing class. And one of the students says, excuse me, Shan, why are there so many stories that we're studying that follow the themes of drownings or disappearances of husbands or fathers or men? And you realise, oh, my God, without me knowing, I've been following a theme. I laughed with that one.
I'm so glad there's at least one laugh in it.
Oh, there are a few. There are a few moments of mirth and quite a few moments of joy. I have to stress that to people who have not read the book. But can you tell us about writing, its impact, its positive impact in this particular zone, and where you were going with the short stories about the drowning fathers?
Yeah. Well, you know, again, I'm so naive. and for someone who prides herself on, you know, trying to employ emotional intelligence, I'm also at times incredibly ignorant about my own emotions. And I literally had not even realized that this theme had been running through my creative writing life for decades. That, yes, somehow this essential story that was the story of my family, that, you know, the story of my father's death, had been mutating and finding its way into just about every story, short story I wrote, or, you know, essays I'd written. Or, I mean, you know, I wrote an essay for Mianjin many years ago about the Balibo journalists who were killed in East Timor. And for me, that was all about politics and my deep interest in East Timor. But again, it's a bunch of men suddenly dying when people didn't expect them to. So it's everywhere, this motif. And it took one of my students to point it out to me. So I come back to where we started, I guess, which is this idea of writing as therapy. It's some part of my brain, and we all have many unknowable secret parts of our brains, don't we? But some part of my brain has just been replaying and replaying and replaying and replaying this story over and over and over again throughout my life. And now I'm writing a story about that story, in which I write about realizing that I've been writing about that story. So it's layer upon layer of kind of self-reflexivity there.
Well, tell me about putting the lecturer's hat on. Tell me about the structure of this book, which is so interesting, because it's not chronological, it's not linear. But I do feel at the end that I have completed a circle.
Yeah, oh, I'm so glad.
What was the setup? What was the premise? Or did you just start writing?
It was a very messy business, and as I always tell my writing students, that is often necessary. Often you just have to go with the messiness until you work out what it is you're doing. So you mentioned earlier that you and I have both written columns for The Age. A lot of the chapters in this new memoir started life as 400-word columns in the Sunday Age, because I was, the personal columns, I was writing about my life. So I had a bunch of jigsaw piece puzzles, if you like, that I could gather together and think, okay, well, that's going to go in somewhere, that's going to go in somewhere, that's going to go in somewhere. And then I've got to fill in all the gaps and go back to the earlier stuff. But to be honest, I guess as a reader and a teacher of writing, I was bored to death with the idea of a strictly linear narrative, a strictly chronological form of storytelling. The thought of doing that myself and starting, say, with, you know, my father's death or whatever and ending with me in 2019, because that's as far as it goes, made me feel nauseous. So, and I've become more and more interested in the way that memories function and the way that we understand ourselves through our most vivid memories. I mean, we are only what we remember in a way.
Can I ask at this point that you started thinking that there'll be a book in this somewhere, I'll land somewhere. Had you been talking to Michael Haywood or any of the team at Text that you had this idea you were playing with?
No, I hadn't.
When did that discussion come into the...
Well, I talked to my agent, Jenny Darling, about probably 4 or 5 years ago about this, and I have been just very slowly noodling away at it, because the other thing that's in the book that we haven't talked about yet is my campervanning travels, which were my way of trying to find something good out of this bad thing that had happened, you know,
you
my childlessness.
You designed your own camper van. I know, it's great.
Well, my stepdad, yes. Really, yes, but I helped him make it.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. So, and it was on those campervanning travels, which I've been doing now for 7 or 8 years, that I started writing the bits that also became the jigsaw puzzle pieces that eventually came together. So, yeah, the book jumps backwards and forwards in time in a way that I was frightened would annoy the readers, but I wanted people to understand intuitively that this is how we do think about our lives. We have a moment of epiphany in the present because of something that happened in the past. And then we have another moment of realization, you know, in the present because of something that happened in the even more distant past. So I'm trying to mimic the way our brain works when it's trying to understand itself.
And the segues, the links. Something triggers off something. And
Yeah. It's a jumping around. It's a sort of a lateral way of thinking that is what the human brain does so marvellously.
Well, Sian, that is kind of an unexpected but nice segue to our question that we love to ask our visiting authors to our show, which is, if you were on the desert island, which author or which book or books would you like to be with? Mm. So let's assume that you've swum for the day, you've collected your coconuts, and you're sitting down to what is in your knapsack on that desert island.
Mm. Well, I suspect I would be very lonely on that desert island, and I would want to find a way of being with people. And I don't know how long I'm going to be on that desert island, so I need some big fat books. So I think Charles Dickens might be the go, because, oh my goodness, so many characters, so hilarious, a lot of fun in those books.
Well, he was the original in a way. He wrote, like you have, he wrote little, well, they weren't little, they were about 1,000 words, I think, each day, really, yeah. And they became novels.
He wrote for newspapers, yes. Didn't he? Yeah.
But he wrote these vignettes that were actually an ongoing story. They were a serial.
Jigsaw puzzle pieces. Yeah.
And had people come back for more tomorrow.
Yeah.
So
me and Chuck on the
I
island.
I think that's a great idea. All those characters, all those voices you could play with.
Yeah, I'd have to act them out myself, of course, all alone.
Sian Pryor, your book is, as I said, it's courageous and it's beautiful, and I'm so pleased that generations of women who are either going through this childless issue or in fact have been through it, that they have this as not only a comfort but as a really terrific resource. Your optimism shines through, and so does your sunshine. Childless, A Story of Freedom and Longing by Sian Pryor, and it is published by Text, and everyone, it's at a bookshop near you, so go hunt it down. Sian Pryor, thank you so much for joining us on the Book Pod.
My pleasure.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.